Okay, it's on. Here we go. Daniel.
Should I go right into an intro?
Yeah, you should get way closer to the mic.
All right. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another exciting episode of the podcast. I'm Daniel Pritchett. I work here at Clear Function. I've been here for about a year now.
And hey, this is David Mahundro, and everyone calls me Mo, and you'll just get used to that, I guess. And I do code and architecture and engineering and computers and everything else that, you know, just whatever I need to do. If I go get drinks for somebody, I do that. So,
all right. And I'm Jesse Brown, and I just do everything development, architecture here at Clear Function.
And my name is Ben Robin. I am a software engineer at Clear Function. So we've got four developers here today to talk about imposter syndrome. Does somebody want to give out a quick definition of like what we mean when we say that? Just for folks who may not be exposed to the terminology?
Sure. It's been a while since I looked it up, but the way I remember it, it's the idea that one finds oneself in a job or role, any kind of position where you feel like maybe somehow you luckily bat your way into something you're not quite qualified for.
Yeah, that's good.
And somehow everyone around you doesn't know it yet, but they're going to find out one day and they're all going to laugh at you and you're going to be fired, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, you're just always worried that you don't know mm-hmm. everything.
You hit on something that when I think about it, I often that's an important part of that fear of being found out.
Yes.
It's not just that if you're surrounded by a lot of people who also are learning it with you,
yeah.
That's different than, oh no, I'm all by myself and alone and mm-hmm. I don't know what I'm doing.
Yeah, it's definitely not just the I don't know what I'm doing, but also the I'm going to be found out. Like everyone will find out that I don't know what I'm doing. That's well said.
Okay.
Yeah, so why do we think it's so prevalent in software development?
Well, have you guys even felt imposter like Daniel, have you felt imposter syndrome before, ever?
I will say a lot more when I was younger, say fresh out of school, working in a new development job. I mean, there's an infinite amount of things you could learn at work, and none of us knows even a fraction of them.
Yeah, that's
and
fair.
And it takes a while to develop the experience to recognize that other people have the same experience. I mean,
I have expected you to just say no.
Me too.
I'm definitely better now than I was years ago in terms of
hopefully we all are
self-appraisal and awareness. But let's say, I don't know, 5 years ago I worked with a database administrator who was in his 70s. He had no interest or exposure to a lot of the cool new stuff I was reading about on the blogs. And he would humor me and we'd talk about it and he'd find it interesting. And he'd often make comparisons to things that he'd done decades ago at different jobs. It's like, oh, that sounds like this other thing I'm doing that isn't called Node.js, for instance.
Mm.
And so once you have enough experience to really appreciate your place in the world and what's all out there that you don't know, I think people get more confidence in themselves, like recognizing who you are and what you know and what you contribute. As long as you're honest with yourself and with other people, there's not so much worry about being found out.
Jesse, what's your exposure to it?
Yeah, I mean, I still think I suffer from it from today even. You know, it's one of those things that you jump into a project and you see some really cool code and you're like, man, how did they ever come up with that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it just doesn't feel like I'm like, I don't know if I'd come up with that solution. But then, you know, I think, like you said, as I got older, I'm figuring out now that, oh, you know what? My solutions, people run into my solutions and think the same thing. And it's not that I'm doing anything outside the box. It's just that you've slowly learned and understood more. And so, you know, those intricate solutions to problems just kind of work themselves out. And you slowly become the person that other people are wondering, like, oh, man, that guy's so far out ahead. And it's really not true. It's just those micro evolutions of your own code. Just getting better over time.
That reminds me of things that you read about the path to mastery or enlightenment in software development. Like, that sounds like you're past the midpoint. You've got working, interesting, complex stuff. And then once you achieve total enlightenment right before you die or whatever happens, then you'll have perfectly reasonable stuff where people will look at it and think, oh, I could have done that, and not realize the other 10,000 solutions you considered and rejected because of all your experience. Like, once you get back to the beginning, it's like, here's a one-liner, it's perfect, and you wouldn't have thought to do that.
I also heard somewhat of a difference between what you get. I felt like, Daniel, you were talking more about a new programming language or a new technology that being exposed to. And I felt like you were, Jesse, we're talking about more of a new project that I'm coming into, so an existing code base.
Yeah, project, but also, you know, just language and technologies, but just really just the solutions is right. more kind of what I was yeah. after. Less okay. about what how they got there, but just more like, you know, because syntax, I never feel like, okay, so yeah, I may not know the fanciest syntax to do that crazy right. one-line statement that, like, some guy who's been doing the language for 10 years will come up with in an instant.
Right.
But, you know, the solutions, I feel like we should be coming to roughly the same overall solutions for simple problems. And sometimes people just knock those out of the park so much in a different way that I'm not even thinking. You know, mm-hmm. functional languages sort of
yeah, that makes sense.
Are one of those things that it took a while to kind of get. But when you see a functional solution at first, you're like, this is just so far out there.
Right.
It'll make you feel like, I don't even know, why would I ever do anything like that? And mm-hmm. and so I think part of that imposter syndrome is just that sort of stuff, you know?
What do you think, Mo?
The first, I've had a couple times where it was just felt it, like really felt it versus, you know, just that feeling. Because in some respects, you know, in this field, as fast as everything moves, it's going to happen. But like when I started college, there's a lot of people who already have some background, like our Keith, you know, the intern who spoke a few times back. He's got more experience with things now than many do, and he's just now starting college, whereas I started college and I knew what HTML was.
Right.
I'm and with you.
You were ahead of the game.
I still recall opening an executable, Windows executable in Notepad, and I thought that was code.
Right.
It was compiled, but I didn't know that. I'd never heard those things, and I'm just like, I'm going to fail. I'm never going to make it.
Yeah.
And another time was, for me, it's whenever it's jumping into a new technology. So maybe the first time that I got into iOS or whenever, I've also experienced it contributing to open source.
Mm-hmm.
You submit a pull request, and it's like, it's to people you've never worked with before. Yeah. And you've heard horror stories about, oh no, they're going to read over my code and they're going to think I'm just a moron. And so I'm not going to, you know, contribute back. And,
I was going to touch on that a little bit on like the things that make right. that even worse. Pull requests are one of those. Like I feel like they're a necessary evil. But for people who are sensitive to imposter syndrome,
right.
it's like putting a spotlight on somebody and it can make them, you know, it can really make it that much more worse for somebody, you know, because they just they're putting their code out there. It's like having an appointment with your like HR person every mm-hmm. time you commit code. And like it feels bad if you're not confident, and it only makes your confidence worse. And so like as a peer reviewer, you have to be conscious of this. Like, it's not even okay. So if say you don't suffer from it, but you've got to think that other people might, and you need to make sure you're reviewing their code for, you know, you got to see if you can judge their comfort level. And like you said, for open source projects, you know, some projects are better at that than others, right. as like having people come in and do code and like just really throwing them against the wall with like small things mm-hmm. that can make them feel really bad.
It's tough to balance that in terms of educating from the reviewer's perspective, educating, and also from going easy on them and being encouraging.
Yeah.
I have an open source project, and there was one person who sent us a contribution. They actually tweeted at me afterwards that it went really positively. And it was just during a time when a lot of people had mentioned just how they had awful experiences contributing back to open source because they just got reamed for doing something that was... Everybody knows you're not supposed to do that.
Right.
And it's just so hard to know.
The lower level you get, the worse it gets, I think. Yeah. Like the people, because the people who live and breathe like networking protocols, like they're just going to be that much harder on, you know, the guy that's doing like a little regex like utility thing in Rails. Yeah.
A lot of that comes down to empathy and just exposure to other people's ideas. I had a case in grad school once where I turned in a set of homework problems for a class. And I was taking a distance ed class, and the TA sent it back, and I got about a 50 or something on these problems.
Oh,
and I looked at it. I thought all the answers are correct. And I asked him, and we were emailing back and forth, and his explanation of why it was so bad was basically I had used the wrong methodology to arrive at my solutions, and everyone knows better than to do it that way. And
interesting.
I don't remember exactly what happened. I think after about 10 emails, he just changed my 50 to an 80 and then went away. But I never did find out exactly what was supposed to be the right way to do it and how I should have known better. Maybe because it was a distance ed thing, maybe this guy had been through 5 years in that one environment. They'd all taken the same classes from the same professors, and so they all had a shared language that I didn't have. But right. That was a weird feeling for me. And I can't recall if I felt like an imposter at the time or not. I mean, I was struggling with the class already, so that was rough, but that was a weird feeling. Like in an open source context, if you have someone who's submitting something and trying to help, you've got to be really slow and deliberate about how you approach it and whether to merge things in. There's some really great blog posts out there. Lady Jesse Frizzell used to work at Docker and now works somewhere else. She apparently is a part of a online community that's open source community management type. So if you're the one responsible for accepting, rejecting pull requests on a major project, here's 20 things to think about. Things like,
right.
Sometimes you're going to have well-meaning people who are sending you terrible code. What do you do about that? Like, do you spend a lot of time? You spend a lot of time building better documentation, making it easier for people, making training. Sometimes you have to say something like, oh, this is great, but it just doesn't fit the technical vision we have for the project, and it's just not going to happen. Sorry, there's a lot of room there.
I kind of feel like one of the positives on imposter syndrome is it's sort of like a self-correcting, self-correcting thing for your code. You know, like if you think that your code's not good enough, then before you hit submit on that pull request, you'll spend an extra couple minutes cleaning up the things that you think are really easy to fix. I think it's sort of a self-correcting thing that just sort of helps developers, really, if you've got it a little bit. I feel like it helps me sometimes.
You know? I feel like there's projects that are more proactive about setting and communicating standards. Like, say, if you're writing programs in Go, the Go programming language, there's no syntax flame wars about white space and whatnot because the tools that come with the language will auto-format your code for you. So that's one less thing to argue about. If you're submitting to a public Go repo, you're going to use Go format and it's going to be okay. Other places will have linters on the build server. So if you submit a pull request, and you could have, that's an easy thing with GitHub, is you could have 10 different bots that are analyzing the code for compliance that'll let you know.
Do you feel bad when the linters do it?
Well, JSLint will hurt your feelings, is what it says in the documentation. But I think that's actually a good way. One of my favorite episodes of Ruby Rogues, they talked about that having a bot being the heavy and telling you, hey, your code needs this little tweak, helps to maintain camaraderie. Like, yes, you broke the rules, but Mo didn't have to come beat you over the head with it and tell you, hey, use two spaces instead of a tab. So you can still have the back and forth.
It feels like there's some obvious levels there too, or like categories of severity of mistake, maybe, if we want to think in those terms. Yeah. It's like you're talking about formatting code the correct way or according to the standard of whatever the project is, which definitely is important. I'm not saying it's not important, but you know, like a security issue is on another level.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And well, you know, when you're getting your pull request checked over and then potentially merge and you get feedback on that, sometimes the feedback feels like it's all on one level, even though it's obvious. Yeah. We all know it's not.
That is really tempting. I used to work on a remote team. We had a ton of different projects going around and a lot of code review would come across my desk. It's really tempting to do superficial stuff. Like, why don't you rename this and change that? Mm-hmm. And this is 1,000 lines. I didn't actually read it. There's probably some structural issues that deserve real attention, but instead I'm just going to zip through and find something stupid and nitpick so I can get back to work because I've got my own deliverables.
That's an interesting thing there. I worked at a place that had a formal, this was before GitHub and things like that. There was still merges, but it was called a third-party review, and you had to have multiple sign-offs on code before it went in. And having, I think that code reviews are good, but when you have that structure around it sometimes where it just becomes routine, then sometimes you just look for the little things. There was something you said there that I was wondering about, is how does remote play in terms of imposter syndrome for y'all?
That's a really good one.
Yeah, my last job was mostly remote, and the people I worked with were really brilliant. It was a collection of people who had a lot of hardware experience as well as like, you know, audio engine sort of level, and I think it could make it feel a little bit worse because they would just pump out these solutions of generating these low level, you know, I'm mostly a web developer. That's sort of what I'm mostly known for. And so that's where I'm more comfortable. And these guys were just doing, you know, just crazy C work to analyze audio files and pull all this information out of something that I couldn't, you know, I'm like, man, that would take me forever. And mm-hmm. I just have to remember that they're specialized. Like they've been doing this for years. They didn't just pick up an audio file and analyze it that day. They've been working, they've been building on the backs of each other and other people for years to make that.
Yeah.
You know, so I think that's one of the things that you have to do to fight imposter syndrome. But as a remote employee, like I couldn't talk to them and they weren't the ones saying like, I didn't, you know, some of these people worked across the ocean, you know?
Right.
And I didn't talk to them all the time. So they're not like in the office and being like, oh yeah, I just had to add a couple lines to this thing that we've mm-hmm. been building on for a decade. But that's, you just had to remember that. And so I think that's, but it did feel a little bit worse remote, I think.
That's a good point.
You feel like they just opened a binary file and tweaked a single bit right there in the middle and suddenly, saw it with their eyes. It's like, yeah. That was the problem.
So,
of course,
to me, you hit on the key, right? It removes the level of personality
mm-hmm.
when you're, depending on the situation, right? I mean, we certainly have different relationships with the projects we've been on and the folks we've worked with. But I think, at least initially, it almost always removes a level of personality. You know, we all go to lunch together every other day or hang out on the weekends or whatever, right? So, I mean, there's something about, I'm not going to kind of assume the things about you guys that I might be tempted to assume about folks I don't know as well.
Right.
Yeah.
And that sort of increases the imposter syndrome. It feels like, man, do these guys know everything? Because I don't feel like I do.
Jesse's point about the audio processing stuff, that's something that's really common for me, is the farther away someone else's experience and expertise is from your comfort zone, the easier it is to be intimidated and to really overblow it. I had an interesting experience once last year. I was interviewing some guy for a potential job role, and he'd worked heavily on this one system that did a lot of audio processing, but we were doing more typical web apps, and we had a lot of back and forth about things like that. Like, I'd say as a web programmer, I tend to be super impressed by people who can write 20 lines of C that do anything. Even though I studied C in college, I haven't touched it since. I'm like, wow, you can do real C, and if there's math in there, I'm going to assume the best from them, even though they're human beings. And so this guy kind of triggered that in me. I'm like, wow, this guy writes his own low-level programs, yeah. and there's math in there, and he did much better in his algorithms class than I did. And then, on the other hand, I'm doing what I consider simple, because I've done it many times, background job processing and all kinds of web request stuff that you get used to as a web developer. And he seemed to have a very similar vibe about what I was doing.
That
was old hat to me and probably to you guys.
Yeah, I've seen the same people like just fall flat on their face, like mm-hmm. just creating a simple HTML form. And you're like, and then it's suddenly you're like, okay, now it all makes sense again. You know, mm-hmm. suddenly you don't feel so bad. You're like, okay, so they're specialized in that. I'm specialized in this, and that's okay. You know, you don't have to know everything. You shouldn't, mm-hmm. you know, no one knows everything. And so I think that, good point.
That type of partnership can be really fun. I know Ben and I like to trade off on different tasks and projects, things that he's done lots and I haven't, and vice versa.
Yeah, I think that, and that may be helpful too in understanding how to cut down on imposter syndrome, is just realizing, kind of as we've been talking about, mm-hmm. that everybody's good at certain things. Everybody has their strengths and everybody has their weaknesses. And so, like, even in the example you're bringing up, when you're pair programming, we tend to trade off on things we know we're better at. And that helps a lot because it cuts down on feeling like he knows a lot more than I do.
Pair programming to me is almost like a pull request, though. It does, for people who are sensitive to imposter syndrome, they've got, it can be just as daunting to them watching someone else code, and they're like, there's just no way I could do that. Or even worse, being behind the keyboard and feeling like they're not producing as fast as the guy who's watching them, you know, because
like if you're sitting there going about your job and then suddenly your boss comes and sits behind you and is like, I'm going to pair with you today,
you
that
like,
might be a little intimidating.
Yeah,
I guess I just haven't felt that too much.
When they're like, you can feel them
wanting to say something,
you should have used a keyboard shortcut for that.
Ooh,
there's a tool that actually does that. There's
productivity things mostly, right?
Yeah.
I think that's it can make you feel a little self-conscious.
If we would all just use Vim, you know, we wouldn't have any trouble.
Well, let's not even get started. I don't like coding my code. Thanks.
So there was another place that I've felt this before was speaking at conferences,
mm-hmm.
too. That is a intense feeling of that, because the people who are speaking are the ones that you've looked up to before and you've heard them.
Right.
And you read their blogs. Like, I still remember the first time I went to a conference and the keynote speaker, it's like, I've read this guy's blog for years. And you could just see the fanboyisms going along when he walks by. And to think like, No, I shouldn't ever submit a talk then, because he's up there. I can't see my name next to so-and-so's.
Oh, yeah. My talk will never be as good as his. Yeah, so why would I submit any talk?
Exactly.
Right? That's
so
the worst of it.
You do the, you sort of lock up, you freeze.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so it's just, but recognizing that other people have felt the same way too.
Right.
So
I've noticed that different people have different ways of coping with that sort of thing. Like one of my favorite podcasters and programming teachers and just general programmers, Katrina Owen, she will practice tens of hours for a presentation. She's got 50 slides. She's worked through all this content. And some people have multiple hours per slide of prep. And I've always been more of an off-the-cuff type. Yep. Like, I'll think about it. I'll maybe work through some examples, and I'll just get out there and do it. And I guess that has, depending on the type of event, that might be more or less appropriate. Like, if you're headlining or keynoting and people have paid $1,000 a seat, they might not want to hear some guy they never heard of come in and wing it, you know?
Hey,
I've gotten that
guys.
Before in rejections. So, yeah, just that there are cases where people, unless someone's just coming because they know my name and all the amazing things I've accomplished, you know? Like, maybe they've listened to a few of my albums, right? So, they might be okay hearing me wing it. But if they're just like, who is this guy?
Unplugged.
And why is he clearly unprepared? They might not take that well.
Yeah. Right.
Time spent's another one. And it relates to people who go home and work on a bunch of side projects.
Right.
Yeah.
That can be intimidating when you first go to like a new place of employment and like, you know, maybe two or three of the guys have like really popular GitHub repos. You're like, man, I don't have any GitHub repos. I don't have any stars. I don't.
Right.
And those people go home and they talk about spiking this new technology like every other day. And you're like, I know nothing about those technologies because you haven't had to use them that. Maybe you've like kept up with a couple blog posts, but you haven't actually coded it. But people. Some people spend their free time doing exactly what they do at work. And if you don't do that, if that's not sort of where you want to spend a lot of your free time, it can feel kind of like you're falling behind.
Right.
It's starting to sound like there's just always a bigger fish that like everybody's sort of on this spectrum of how good they are at programming or presentation skills or whatever it is. And there's always going to be somebody who's better than me, and there's always going to be somebody that I'm probably better than.
Mm-hmm.
But it's almost like it boils down to, you know, comparison is sort of stealing my feeling positive about this or continuing to be productive or whatever it is.
Right.
But that if I would just come to it with an attitude of trying to learn, realizing I don't know everything, that may be the most helpful thing I can do personally.
So I'd say that it might help to look at it as individuals have different dimensions to their lives. I've noticed that a lot of the people that I've been a bit jealous of who are maybe on the popular conference circuit speaking, getting paid to speak and invited to speak at big conferences that I'm curious about, they tend to have a certain profile in terms of home life. Like maybe they'll have some small kids and they'll almost certainly have someone else taking care of them while they're gone 20 hours a month or whatever. And so then you think about it and you're like, well, I'd love to get invited to be the headliner at RailsConf and maybe somebody would give me $10,000 and a plane ticket to go with it. But if you stop and look behind the scenes at the lifestyle of the people who wind up there, you're like, well, that's not really how I want to live my life after all.
They've made sacrifices elsewhere
that
you haven't to get there, you know, and that's okay. You know, different sacrifices.
Yeah.
Not that you haven't made sacrifices, but just you've chose different, you know, you've prioritized different things over them and they want to be a speaker. And so they've prioritized that and spent that extra time and making sure that their schedules can be as flexible as they need to be to be the headliners at things like that. You know?
Yeah. I'd say it's pretty rare if you look behind the scenes that you feel that you're completely outclassed in every way. Like this person has done all the same things I've done, but better. And they have no regrets. I mean, that'd be kind of weird. But usually there's differences.
Okay, so we've kind of talked about how we've felt imposter syndrome in the past. Some of the sort of hidden pros, Jesse, like you mentioned, it being a sort of a self-correcting thing that helps improve your code at the very least. And then a lot of the cons as well of just kind of it sucks to feel this way. So what do we do to sort of, what should we do about imposter syndrome, I guess, is the best way to put it.
So I think one of the things that I've read and sort of tried to practice is don't focus on how fast or not even necessarily how great your code looks compared to somebody else's, but more about the value that code is bringing the business, you know, because at the end of the day, that's sort of what you're hired to do is bring value to the business. And so at the end of the day, what did you accomplish that helped the business move forward? And there's always something there. You know, when you actually did that pull request and it got merged in, you added some value to that company.
I think for me, I think about it from the perspective of what can I do about it, and then what can I do to help others with it. And so I would say two things. One I mentioned earlier is just trying to remember that nobody is pretending like, so I shouldn't pretend like I know everything.
Right.
I'm not expected to know everything. And just knowing that is sort of comforting. But if I continue to have the attitude of a learner, then I can sort of take more of a humble posture about, yeah, I'm learning. We're all here learning together. And I feel like that's helpful. So that being the case with others, like if I'm doing pull request reviews, you know, I want to not sort of bash other people's code,
right?
Because that's only going to make it worse. And I feel like, you know, even if they don't know something that I know, it's sort of like I didn't always know that.
Yeah.
You know, right. I learned that at some way. And right. So maybe this is just their opportunity to learn that.
That's really good to look at it as if everyone has their own strengths and experiences, and anybody can learn something from any other person,
yeah,
even if they're,
yeah,
half your age.
Like, absolutely.
I had a job better part of a decade ago where we were talking about instituting some code reviews, and one of the busier senior developers basically made it known that he wouldn't mind as long as he was doing all the reviewing. Like, nice. He didn't have anything to learn from anybody, and he was too busy to really have these conversations, but he might humor us a little bit. So that's not really the vibe I think anybody wants in their team,
right,
review. It's not,
right,
collaborative growth.
There's something, I think, that if you can find someone who has been in it longer, maybe,
mm-hmm,
like both find a mentor or be a mentor.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
It doesn't even have to be something official, but maybe you find someone online that you just like, I'm going to start reading their stuff, and just because you're going to find that everyone else feels imposter syndrome too.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
You know,
mm-hmm, yeah. I was going to say finding someone to teach, like what I used to do a few years back, I haven't gone on Stack Overflow and actually answered questions in a while, but was to answer questions on Stack Overflow about a topic you're comfortable with.
Yeah.
You know, don't go in there and try to answer, you know, iOS questions. If this is your like first month of doing iOS, it's probably, mm-hmm, not going to go well. You're going to make yourself feel worse. But if you really know, you know, ASP.NET MVC, then go on there and answer,
right,
some ASP.NET MVC questions, because even though you know the answer is probably on Stack Overflow somewhere, because, you know, most of the questions are going to ask different ways, but they're going to, mm-hmm, end up being the same response. There's someone out there who's feeling that way right now, and they ask that question, and by you answering it, you're going to make yourself feel better, and you're going to help that guy out, right?
Right.
Because you're going to be like, oh yeah, it turns out I did know that. I didn't even have to Google it, you know?
I'd say that being humble, as Ben mentioned a minute ago, it definitely helps to have your own awareness of who you are and where you are, but some situations, especially professionally, make that easier than others. If you're in an environment where, I don't know, people get fired every week for reasons publicly, then you're going to have a harder time being,
right,
confident. And you may be, there may be more caginess about how much weakness can I show and how open can I be about my growth. If you're in an environment where everyone's,
yeah,
nice, you're getting positive affirmations.
Absolutely.
Everyone's,
absolutely,
expecting each other to grow and help each other out.
Right.
Then you can be a lot more open.
Yeah. When you were talking earlier, I was actually thinking, you know, as kind of one of the younger guys here, I'll admit, even though my age is a big question mark,
mm-hmm,
as kind of one of the younger guys here, I feel like with some of you guys who have been doing this longer, I've never felt here like, oh man, like they really think I should know this, and I'm like worse off because I don't.
Right.
Instead, I feel like these guys just want to help me learn, and so I'm going to try and learn and do better, you know, next time or whatever it is, which is cool.
That reminds me, early in my career, someone told me that you will take a production system down because all of us have done it before. And so just in terms of when you do mess up, if you're in a situation unlike what Daniel was talking about, where you can communicate openly about that,
mm-hmm,
it really helps to know that other people before you have failed, because we all will mess up at some point. And so whenever I did mess up and, oh no, the system's down, it's all Mo's fault, everyone's sort of like, you know, learn from it. Keep in mind, we've all messed up before, too.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, there's a classic programming joke about that. Like, somebody breaks the production system, the company loses $1 million, and someone comes up to the boss, and like, so $1 million, they're just going to fire the guy, right? And the boss says, why would I fire him? I just spent $1 million teaching him not to break this.
Exactly.
If I hire somebody else, they're going to break, right, it, too. So this is the one person who knows not to make this mistake.
Yeah, I remember when Amazon went down for like an hour or something. One time, and like it was, I think he got on Hacker News after Amazon went down again one time, and he's like, yeah, I totally got, you know, I took down Amazon for like an hour, and they're like, oh, I remember that. And he's like, did you lose your job? He's like, no. They were like, why would I do that? Like, so it was probably fake,
mm-hmm,
based off of that, but I can imagine it being real.
It's just, I mean, obviously, you know, taking down production systems bad, but just recognizing and, you know, being able to speak about those mistakes.
Yeah.
And because everyone else will feel that freedom too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We certainly don't want that situation to happen, right. But it's sort of learning from it and growing from it instead of it just being a terrible thing that happened.
Right. And that leads to a healthy decision-making mindset, assuming that things will break. What are your fallback plans? What are your backup options?
Yeah.
You do run into people who think, you know, we've got the one system that hasn't died in 5 years. It probably never will. And no, we don't have backups or disaster recovery or whatnot. If you're lucky, you never use your backups, but yeah. Still nice to have. So do you guys feel like imposter syndrome is mostly confined to a professional context? Do you ever feel this outside of work?
Only professional for me.
Yeah?
I've never really felt it anywhere except for programming.
All right.
I asked my wife about that, and she's in speech therapy, and she hasn't felt it to the same degree. I don't know if it's just because the body of work in it's just the movement.
Coding's more measurable. Like, I can write a function, and right. You can write a function, mm-hmm. and most of the time someone can objectively look at it and tell which one's better, or based on, if not just the way the code's written, or time spent.
So would you say that
so
makes...
I think it can, like, you as a person, you see someone else write it, mm-hmm. and they wrote it a different way that looks more efficient, or they wrote it way faster than you thought they could write it. Mm-hmm. Like, I think that's what makes you, I think that's the sort of profession that makes it. It has to be a little more objectively,
yeah,
you know, objectively identifiable.
Yeah, there's a lot of objectivity in what we do and sort of truthiness, if you will.
So you're saying because your output can be somewhat measured. Objectively evaluated, that it's easier to feel like an imposter than when you might not in a place where
I think that's
maybe
fair.
People could all be making it up and no one really know.
Yeah, I think so. I doubt doctors really feel it. Like, they see different patients most of the time, right? And so it's not like they're going to come across the exact same person with the exact same problems.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're going to go at the... I don't know. It just feels different. Like, I obviously, I'm not a doctor, so maybe they do feel it. But
yeah.
I feel like it's probably a lot harder to... quantify how much better a doctor is based off of your day-to-day work.
Right. So now you've got me wondering how this correlates to personality types. We did not invite our two manager types to this conversation, and I have observed that managerial types tend to be precise and confident. You know, you pick something and you stick with it, and that helps to inspire the people around you. So maybe we're all introverted, head-scratching developers coming up with the whole architecture plan. I
will say, when I had my experience as management for a couple of years there, I definitely still felt it.
Yeah, right?
I felt it almost more because of my limited experience.
Do you
with
miss it?
I not really.
I had a brief exposure to management, and I don't miss it much. I mean, I guess it was kind of cool, but at the same time, I wonder, people who continue to seek it out and pursue it throughout a career, are they feeling this too, or are they pretty sure they were right all along?
So I think doctors is a real... I kind of want to jump back to something you said, Jesse. I think doctors is a really interesting example of maybe they feel imposter syndrome, maybe they don't. We don't know because we're not doctors. That's okay. But it's interesting that doctors talk about practicing medicine. You know, not so much this sort of doing sense, but it's the idea is that we're practicing, we're learning as we go. We try; it's sort of a trial and error thing in one sense, right? I mean, when you get a prescription for something and it doesn't work, they prescribe you something else because they've ruled out whatever they thought it was. And so there's this concept of I'm practicing this, which I think would help to not have imposter syndrome.
Yeah, maybe. I don't think it would instill confidence in clients.
Yeah.
I'm practicing developing a website.
Well, yeah.
But yes, I mean, I get your point, and it does make sense. Like,
there's,
you know,
definitely a lot to be said for your attitude and the words you use to talk to yourself and to other people. I definitely pursue a sort of that same scientific method when I'm doing production support debugging. Like, oh no, this email has been sending to the wrong place for 2 months, what happened? I start taking notes and trying to triangulate the issue, and that sounds kind of like you're changing your prescriptions. You just have to be deliberate about it, or else maybe it doesn't count. If you just throw something out, and then I've been in other cases where I wasn't taking notes properly, and I'll be debugging something all day, and I'll wind up trying the same thing 5 times because I keep forgetting where I am.
Yeah, I was just thinking, there's nothing that would make me feel more like an imposter than hitting the same exact problem and not knowing what to do every single time.
Right.
So, like, learning why something broke when it does is really helpful.
There's almost a totally separate discussion there in terms of the whole profession and craft.
Yeah.
So, do we need an episode on debugging or after programming? Where are you going?
I was just talking more about the practice aspect of doctors. Like, they have a whole field, and then there's lots of discussions out there about development.
Should there be
engineering? Is engineering actually an engineering practice, or is it something else entirely? Should there be a professional? Apprenticeship.
I've heard that a lot.
I mean,
there's professional associations, there's licensure, there's continuing education requirements, which people may or may not take seriously, but at least it's there, right?
Mm-hmm.
Some of us do things like that, but I'm probably not getting my required 100 hours or whatever that I can sign off on a sheet this year.
I can't imagine, knowing what I know about those things, that it would suddenly make me feel, ha ha, I've got this all figured out now.
So as we're kind of wrapping up here, any kind of concluding comments you guys would bring into this conversation?
The first thing that comes to mind for me is to not only be honest with yourself about where you've come from and where you're going. You know, you're on a journey. You don't know everything. You plan to know more and experience more. But also think about the levels of support and reassurance you're getting. If you're in a situation where you feel like your imposter syndrome's exacerbated because everyone's out to get each other and there's just not much security or trust, maybe that's something you could work on. Like, look for a different environment where people are happy to be there and are helping each other out and not fighting for scraps.
And like you said, if you aren't experiencing imposter syndrome, maybe, you know, just put yourself in someone else's shoes who you are, you know, maybe working with or working over, and try to make sure that you're just trying to feel what they're feeling a little bit and make sure you're just not, you know, kicking them while they're down.
I agree.
Good conversation, guys. You've been listening to It Depends, a podcast by Clear Function. Clear Function is a group of happy engineers based in Memphis, Tennessee. We partner with visionaries to bring their ideas to life. For more information, check out our website at clearfunction.com.